done with my Oreo.
Okay, good.
Do we really know what happened?
The brother did.
The brother. That's what I thought too.
I mean, that seems like kind of obvious.
Hey, do you want to talk about death?
Yeah. I mean, that's
a mystery, murdery thingy.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. Hello.
Were we supposed to do it at the same time?
I don't know. We kind of looked at each other and then.
Okay, ready to start again.
Okay. Welcome Hello. To. Oh, Damn shit. It. Okay. Welcome to Mystery Murdery Thingy.
Welcome to Mystery Murdery Thingy.
I don't know what you're trying to do. I'm
My
sorry.
My name is Chloe.
My name is Mario.
Welcome.
Yeah. What's up? Hey. How's it going?
It's a late Wednesday night.
It's a typical second Wednesday night.
We're very relaxed.
Yes.
A good time.
Yes. Talking about some mysteries.
And murderies.
And thingies.
Let's get started. Let's just do it. Let's go.
Go. Am I going first?
No, I want to go first.
Okay, you go first.
I would like to go first. So, I am going to talk about, I usually don't like to get into the types of disappearances where people just straight up vanish.
Right.
Because usually it's like, here's the victim. This is what they were like when they were alive. We love them. And then they vanish one day and that's it. No one knows anything. Cold case. Period.
Mm-hmm. The coldest of cold cases.
It's just
some instances.
There's nothing to go. There's nothing left to say.
Right.
And those are so sad.
You don't know if they died. You don't know if they're still alive. You don't know where they are.
Right, right.
So much mystery.
But this one is a disappearance. I'm going to talk about the Death Valley Germans. So this is a pretty popular case, I'd say. Have you heard of it?
No.
Okay. So Death Valley, California. Actually, this particular area we're talking about is on the California-Nevada border. And so my main source was a long-form article written by Tom Mahood, who, he was actually one of two people that discovered the remains.
Oh. And who was he writing for?
His own website.
His own
personal website. Outofhand.org. And Wikipedia, of course, and an article from NBC News, but it had an Associated Press label on it.
Oh, that happens, yeah.
I don't know what that means.
It's because, like, the Associated Press, it's like a wire service. So they like, run their own news, but they also provide news stories for, like, a lot of other people. Oh. Like Reuters or AFP. There's like, a bunch of different ones.
I did not click any farther.
I see.
So I don't know who wrote it.
Sometimes they're unsigned.
The Pahrump Valley Times.
Pahrump, Pahrump. Hey, that guy didn't give the governor a perump. Give the governor a perump.
Perump. How would you say this? P-A-H-R-U-M-P? Perump?
Yeah, Pa-rump? That sounds right.
Valley Times, two-part article by Robin Flincham. So, the discovery. I like to title my
cool
each one.
The Chapter discovery. 1, the discovery.
So, the Death Valley Germans were a German tourist family of four. The last trace of them was July 23rd of 1996. 3 months later, on October 21st, Death Valley National Park Ranger Dave Brunner, who was doing a routine drug search, like aerial helicopter, like looking for drugs, of the backcountry, you know.
Sure. People fucking planting weed and.
Yes. He found a van parked in a wash in Anvil Canyon, which is a remote area of Death Valley. Mm. Note that this entire area is remote. It's a desert.
Particularly remote.
It actually stretches about 3 million acres, this particular space that we're talking about. More specifically, the summer of 1996 was one of the hottest on record, with temperatures getting as high as 130 degrees.
Jesus.
Yeah, fucking scary. So, the van was a green 1996 Plymouth Voyager with California plates. For those who, I don't know how car savvy you have to be to, if you, like, can picture a Plymouth Voyager.
I don't know what any cars look like. I know what a Dodge Charger looks like, and I know what a Mustang looks like.
Do you know what a Chevy Cruze looks like?
I have one, so yes.
I was gonna say.
It looks like every other car.
I know, there's, like, three of them in, like, the vicinity.
Yeah.
Okay, anyway, moving on. So, a 96 Plymouth Voyager, it's basically a basic passenger van soccer mom.
You're basic.
It was odd, though, that the car was there in the first place, because this area of the park doesn't have any legal roads, and you can't get through it anyway. The only way you can get through it is with, like, a four-wheeler.
Mm-hmm.
Like a desert bike that, but like, even if you could get through it, that's illegal.
Yeah.
In 1994, when the park was designated as an official wilderness area, that was when vehicles, were prohibited. So the van was stuck. The axle was stuck like in sand, basically. Both rear wheels were flat, as well as the left front tire. So three of the four wheels were flat. The tracks and the dirt suggested they drove about 200 feet with those flat tires before stopping. The doors were locked, and there was no sign of the owner. Nobody was there. After running the license plate, they found that the car was reported stolen on September 10th of 1996. So this is October. The vehicle was actually a rental. It was owned by Dollar Rent-A-Car. July 8th of 1996, the car had been rented to a group of four German tourists in Los Angeles. So the car was due back. It was taken it was due back July 26th, but was never returned. It was policy for the rental agency to wait 30 days past the due date before reporting it as stolen. And they ran their names. The German tourists were Egbert Rimkus, 34, his son Georg Weber, 11, Egbert's girlfriend Cornelia Meyer, 28, and her son Max Meyer, 4. When running their names through the database, they actually found an Interpol alert on them that was put in on August 14th. So they were officially missing. The next day, DVNP investigator Eric Inman and personnel from the Inyo County Sheriff's Office, they went back down there and they searched the van itself. So the items that were found in the van: two unopened bottles of beer, Bud Ice, and one empty bottle, one empty and one three-quarter full bottle of bourbon. How do you say bourbon?
Bourbon.
Is bourbon?
Yeah.
I'm embarrassed.
Unless you're, like, you know, in France, you know, bourbon.
Several empty large water and juice containers, luggage and clothing, numerous exposed rolls of 35mm film, and a 35mm camera. One new Coleman sleeping bag in its box, and one empty Coleman sleeping bag box. A tent, a pipe with tobacco, a leather card carrier containing Swiss bank cards, and a Citicorp card for Egbert. Card with the, quote, Seahorse Resort in San Clemente, numerous toys, and an unused compact spare tire and jack. So here's what they think the rough timeline is. The family left Frankfurt, Germany, and arrived in Seattle on July 8th, where they then left for Los Angeles. The van they rented was due back the 26th. I think they got there on the 23rd. And their flight back home left on the 27th. So there was no evidence of them ever leaving the USA either. On July 12th, Egbert made a call to his bank in Dresden requesting $1,500 to be wired to a Bank of America branch in the Los Angeles area. The family then ended up in Las Vegas at the Treasure Island Hotel. And July 21st, there is record of Egbert. He faxed a request form from the hotel to his ex-wife and his son's mother, Heike Weber, requesting additional funds to be sent to him. So the hypothesis was that they were low on funds, especially because the money would never sent. And the family checked out of the hotel the next day, and they were headed to Death Valley.
Hmm.
So what we know next is based on visitor logs, items found in the car, and photos recovered from the camera. Receipt records at the Furnace Creek Visitor Center show that on July 22nd, two copies of the booklet, quote, Death Valley National Monument Museum text in the German language were sold. The tourists spent a night at Hanuapa Canyon near Telescope Peak before arriving in Warm Springs Canyon, north of where the van was eventually found. So the visitor's log had a note written in German that translates to, quote, going through the pass. Cornelia Meyer signed her name as well as the rest of the family's names. The pass, quote, unquote, most likely refers to Mengele's pass, and the only way to cross, and Mengele's pass is the only way to cross to the Panamint mountain range, and I think they were headed to Yosemite. This course is rugged, it's tough, it's not something a passenger van would be able to get through. In the van, they also found an American flag labeled Butte Valley Stone Cabin, which is also called Geologist's Cabin, and that indicating that they had been there at one point. The cabin, the Geologist's Cabin, quote unquote, it's a shelter that's maintained by volunteers in the area, and there's food, and there's also a source of fresh water that's nearby. Their whereabouts between being at the visitor center on July 22nd and then signing the logbook at Warm Spring, July 23rd, were unknown at the time. So there's this huge gap of time. So the first search. Search teams canvassed the area over a period of 4 days, October 23rd to the 26th. So each day they went out and expanded the search area. They had 8 horses, Kern County Sheriff's Mounted Search and Rescue, 2 helicopters doing an aerial search, 45 searchers in the field at all times. A reporter estimated that there were about 250 people involved in the search at one time or another. And they were expecting this to be somewhat successful in that this was a hiking trail, but it wasn't something you would go through, like, on vacation in a van. And there were rescues that went on. I mean, mm-hmm. not all the time. I don't know how often, but
you wouldn't think that they would have gone too far.
Exactly. Right.
That's what I was thinking.
Exactly. On the first day, searchers found a Bud Ice beer bottle in a bush about 1.7 miles from the van's location. And they matched the other ones that were in the van. There was a shady area near the bush that had been brushed clear of rocks and dirt, suggesting that someone had sat there to escape the afternoon sun. And so those were really, that was it.
Hmm.
Over the next 4 days, there weren't any other clues that were found. So this was the only large scale official search. Since then, there have been numerous other searches. Park rangers looked into the mine shafts as well later on, but they didn't find anything. Hikers and other enthusiasts organized searches. Private teams went out to search as well, but there's not much known about those.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing more was found, and the trail went cold for about 13 years. The Meyer family had gone through the legal procedure of declaring their daughter Cornelia and their grandson Max dead, even though there was still uncertainty and no proof. Ursula Rimkus, Egbert's mother and Georg's grandmother, she never gave up hope and just simply went on to wait. Tom Mahood comes into the picture when he hears the story in the summer of 2008. So this was one of two cases that got him interested in the search and rescue field in general. So not too long later, February of 2009, he joined the Riverside Mountain Rescue Unit, RMRU, and trained as much as possible. So he basically became a part of a search party, a search and rescue party. And he also talked about in the article how he learned, like, man tracking, which sounds weird, but it's basically you learn how to track a person instead of, like, an animal.
Sure.
Per se.
A human animal.
Yes. He did his own research with the case. He was super fascinated with it, with the help of a woman named Debbie Breitenstein, one of the original searchers, as well as reports from two other private individuals, one being Dick Hasselman, a retired professor from Virginia Tech, and Emmett Harder, who did his own search and report titled, quote, The Cauldron of Fire. Tom also received a copy of the Death Valley Investigators report by Eric Inman. And Eric Inman was one of the guys that was first on the scene and looked at the evidence in the van.
Mm-hmm.
So he gathers all this research and he concocts a theory. And it's very well thought out. It's the basics of it is that the tourists made a ton of honest mistakes that ended up with deadly consequences. So Tom notes that the family was probably low on funds as they traveled to Yosemite via Death Valley. Egbert, like I mentioned before, Egbert had tried contacting his ex-wife back home for money, but it was never received. Some of the photos suggest that they had camped on their own in Hanawapa Canyon, where there was also water. So I think when I was reading this, there was a couple different ways they could go, but they went over there because there was water. If they were low on funds, they couldn't have rented a cabin, and they couldn't camp in the main valley because of the heat. And this was not a conventional camping spot. Overall, their plan made sense, but they didn't prepare for how difficult it is to camp and hike through the area without proper expertise and equipment. All they had was a map in the pamphlet. Mahood's theory goes on to explain that the tourists continued south to Warm Spring, hoping to find more people and info there, but it was deserted, and then Warm Spring was where they signed the register, and then they moved on. The road got worse as they headed back towards Butte Valley, and they stopped at the geologist's cabin, hoping again to find other tourists and information about the route, but there was no one, so they moved on. When approaching Mengel Pass, it was getting more difficult to navigate the terrain, and they realized they needed to head back. It was late afternoon. The pamphlet they had suggested an alternate route via Anvil Canyon Road instead of going back through Warm Spring Road where they had just been. This was an error in the pamphlet. Going back through Warm Spring Road would have taken another 2 hours and they had already navigated through those tough conditions. So, like, in that case, looking at the pamphlet, it made sense to go back through the other road. So they headed back to their last checkpoint, Geologist's Cabin, and turned down Anvil Canyon Road, which was a mistake because the road soon turned into a wash, which I learned, I didn't know what a wash was. Basically, a dried up stream at the bottom of a canyon that it's like dried up mud.
Sure.
And it has the potential to flow rapidly during a flash flood. So it's like, it's kind of like right outside our door.
Oh yeah. We know exactly what that is. Right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So at this point they are stranded. Tom guesses that someone, probably Egbert, traveled 1.7 miles east, sat down at a bush and drank a beer, and that was the evidence that was later found in the search. Probably to form some type of plan. So here's what Tom thinks happened. Quote, and this is a quote from the article that he wrote. Quote, remember that the Germans were new to the desert southwest and unfamiliar with things that to some of us are so obvious we don't even realize we take them for granted. The Germans had likely seen many military installations in Europe and they had certain commonalities. They all had fences which were regularly patrolled by armed personnel. From Egbert's perspective and knowledge pool, the likelihood of patrols or sentries at the edge of a military installation would have seemed quite high. End quote. So, however, that's not the case with U.S. military bases, because there isn't fencing or personnel, really. The security, it's the vastness of the desert. Like, that's pretty much it.
Sure.
The area that was nearby, China Lake NWC, Naval Weapons Center, I believe, was 8 to 9 miles south of Anvil Canyon. And when Tom went to go eventually search this place, he sat where he thinks Egbert sat and, like, looked around that area, and he could, like, see 8 to 9 miles, like, ahead. He could see things in the distance.
Right, because the desert, the, like, air, it's, like, whatever. It makes it seem like things that are further away are actually closer. Isn't that...
Yeah.
That's, like, a thing, right? It's, like, an optical illusion.
It sounds right to me. In a nutshell, Tom did some extrapolating with his knowledge of the area and came to the conclusion that the family most likely headed south, an area that hadn't been searched yet. This was another 8 to 9 miles south.
Mm-hmm.
So, Tom Mahood acts on his theory, he convinces one of the RMRU teammates, Les Walker, to join him on this search. So they started early in the morning of November 11th, 2009. The plan's pretty complicated in that I need a map and, like, knowledge of the area to properly explain it.
Right. But that's what you were talking about with me before. Yeah, I was like, how am I going to talk about this? I'm not sure.
But I narrowed it down to the basics.
Okay.
Or that they headed south of Anvil Canyon. So, and there's a nice map that I'll post. There are three canyons that ran south from where the van was found. And they chose Squaw Spring, which is a canyon on the west, because it had a source of water. So they reached Squaw Spring at about 2 p.m., filled up their water, then traveled to a canyon on the east where they set up camp for the night. And they, Tom stressed how difficult this was.
Mm-hmm.
And, they had all this gear. It was heavy. It was hot. It was rough terrain. It's not easy.
Mm.
This was a very difficult hike. And so they set up camp, and then they headed out early the next day to continue south along their planned search route, and then they set up a perimeter. So Les and Tom split up, but they stayed in contact through radio or just, like, yelling at each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like, across the canyon. Hey. Yeah. 8:43.
Hey. Hey. Have you found them yet?
8:43 a.m., Les finds a wine bottle. Only fragments of a label could be seen. Not too long later, Les radios over again, finds what he thinks is toilet paper, but upon further inspection, it was pieces of a daily planner with writing in German. Then he radios again a few minutes later, quote, "Tom, we have some bones over here," end quote. 9:14 a.m., Tom joins Les, who was about 600 meters northeast of him. Skeletal fragments were spread over a wide area. Les had also found a wallet and ID cards with the name Cornelia Meyer, her passport and bank ID with photo, business cards from places they had stayed on their trip, found remains of a small shoe, possibly that of a woman or a child. There was a toothbrush and a tube of toothpaste or some sort of salve. They found another clear glass bottle, which was later matched to the same Ice Bud bottles that were found in the van. They picked up the wallet and ID cards to prove to the DVNP rangers that, like, this was legit.
Mm-hmm.
Their reasoning, they, like, knew, you know, it was evidence, but their reasoning was, one, it had been out there for 13 years. Two, it was the thing that they could take back, where it wouldn't be harmed in that case.
Mm-hmm.
Something physical like that.
Sure.
Besides, like, you know, the bones.
Yeah.
They made sure not to disturb the skeletal remains, and they headed back north. So this starts the beginning of a very long process of working with the Inyo Sheriff's Office, the FBI, and the DVNP. If y'all want to read the article, it is by Tom Mahood called "The Hunt for the Death Valley Germans." It's a great article, but he goes into more detail of what that was like and how they were just, like, search and rescuers who were off duty that, like, found this stuff. So they're like, oh, these guys are enthusiasts. So they were, like, kind of skeptical sometimes. But their knowledge of the area is what really, and his really smart reasoning. I mean, the fact that he headed south based on that maybe they thought there were people somewhere, mm-hmm. and there's a military base that has people. Maybe, you know, it was a lot of reasoning that I was like, oh, like, that makes sense. And then it was actually successful. So what happened? Nothing more was found. I mean, including the remains of the children, there was no evidence of foul play. Eventually the bones were identified as belonging to a male and a female. And the only DNA that was recovered was from the bones of Egbert. Those were the ones that they could only, like, positively identify that it was him. But we don't know where the children are, where their remains are. We don't know cause of death, probably dehydration, exhaustion, who knows. But yeah, they did find the skeletal remains, but we still don't know where the children are or We don't definitively know why they went that way, first of all. And we don't know how they got there or how long they survived either. There's still like a lot of questions. Right. You know, lots of whys, like his credit cards were still in the van. There wasn't any activity recorded on Cornelia's bank cards. Why did they leave the van? Right?
Well, that seems like, yeah, the most kind of pressing question is like, why would they leave their only source of shelter in a desert?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it goes to his point that, like, they didn't know, but I don't know. That seems pretty obvious.
They didn't have many choices at all, really.
I guess so. Yeah, I mean, obviously, I've never been in that situation, right?
And their flight was scheduled to leave the next day.
Yeah. So maybe they felt like they needed to, like, resolve this quickly.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Interesting.
And they were drinking.
Yeah, I guess that could be part of it, too. Maybe their judgment wasn't, you know, totally clear.
Yeah, and that dehydrates you, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, that, like, would not have helped.
Yeah. But, so, I mean, one of the... There's a lot of crazy theories. Mm-hmm. But the one I like was... some relatives reported that Egbert was, like, really into... technology and conspiracy theories and stuff like that. And so, like, one of the things that they're like, oh, what if Egbert was trying to get into China Lake, the Naval Weapons Center, to see some, like, type of exotic technology or, like, solve some sort of conspiracy theory? You know, did they see something they weren't supposed to see? Were they taken down by, like, black ops? Like, yeah. Which is very silly. It's,
yeah, it's
not
silly.
Plausible. China Lake isn't... It's not like...
Why would they do that?
Hiding things over there.
Also, why wouldn't they just arrest them? Like, that's what would happen.
Exactly.
When people wander onto Area 51, they don't get shot. They get arrested.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, it's pretty stupid.
But, yeah, that's it. And then, again, my main source was the article by Tom Mahood. And, yeah.
Cool. Thank you, Chloe.
Thank you.
Okay. Now it's my turn. Okay, so
part
I'm...
Part two.
Another part two of the many parts two that we've done.
Ooh.
Over the 93 episodes now that we're up to. So like I said last week, we're going to be talking about some other people dealing with... and some people... trying to solve the mysteries that surround, you know, rare diseases and conditions and so forth. And at the beginning of last episode, I kind of gave a little primer as to what is a rare disease, all that kind of stuff. So see that for those kind of contextual details. But, yeah, it's interesting. I was watching this, which I didn't really write about, but I was watching the Netflix documentary series that Chloe kind of pointed me to called Diagnosis, mm-hmm. and specifically episode one called Detective Work. And it's produced by the New York Times. But anyway, it's great. I would really encourage you to go and watch it. Just a really great episode about one person trying to solve their one mystery of their mm-hmm. disease and how it affects her and her family and her whole outlook on life, and the really kind people that help her to solve her mystery. So, I would just encourage you, because we also talked about how this is about people suffering from disease and their struggle and the people surrounding them struggle
yes.
to solve these mysteries. Like, that's
yes.
the core of it, and their experience, and their, you know... I don't know, just the wonder of their stories and their mysteries and seeing them kind of overcome these things. And I think that episode really encapsulates that really well in a way that I just can't, you know, because it's her and her family talking and her... Anyway, I'm going to start crying if I talk about it too much, but you will cry. If you don't cry watching that, your heart is stone. So anyway, I just kind of wanted to plug that. Kind of first of all, but it also kind of speaks to the first thing that I wanted to talk about, because I said last week, like, it was very doom and gloom. There's a lot of doom and gloom with this kind of thing, right? But there's also hope. There's also, like, people trying to help and, like, doing what they can. And part of that is this thing called the Undiagnosed Diseases Network, which is run out of the National Institutes of Health here in the United States. And when one, you know, just absolutely cannot be diagnosed, right, which is very common for people with rare diseases, eventually one may end up going to the Undiagnosed Diseases Network. And it's essentially an organization kind of within the National Institutes that connects clinicians, researchers, and patients to help, you know, diagnose those just impossible-to-diagnose cases. And a Harvard researcher, Isaac Cohen, put it this way to the Boston Globe, quote, "The whole idea here is to enable to anyone with an undiagnosed disease to apply, be evaluated, and get referred with all relevant medical data," mm-hmm. close quote. So just, you know, it sounds really simple, but that is, like, impossible to do for so many people. And there's so many layers of bureaucracy and so many doctors and specialists that they have to go through.
I mean, we also just have such a great healthcare system.
I know,
here.
Right? Oh, it's so. I think it's perfect.
Yeah. No.
I know, right?
Heavy sarcasm.
Very, very heavy.
Heavy sarcasm.
Yeah, I think you can tell. So, and you'll definitely get that from watching the Netflix series. The irony, the cruel, I should say, irony of our healthcare system, as opposed to some other countries' healthcare systems. And per Wikipedia, the Undiagnosed Diseases Network has been around for about 5 years. And as of 2017, 1,519 patients had been referred, about 40% of whom were accepted into the program, 260 of whom ended up actually receiving, you know, actual diagnoses.
Wow.
And when you see how that impacts one person's life,
yeah,
260 doesn't sound like a lot, but it is an incredible amount. For any one of these people to get their diagnosis, which may help to allow them to be treated or at least to know what the hell is going on, it's mind-bogglingly important. So for 260 people to have been able to do that over a few years is really incredible, honestly. And it's only because these people focused on breaking through the, you know, Kafka-esque healthcare system that we certainly have in this country, so that patients and advocates, you know, don't go from doctor to doctor, but rather the doctors, the specialists, the testing, anything that's necessary to get the diagnosis comes to them.
Yeah.
That they're plugged into that network. It's not that.
But it's about resources. You
know, exactly. Resources and visibility. That's like, If I could only make 2 points out of this whole story, resources and visibility are, like, the two things that help to solve these mysteries. Because, again, these are... The internet. This is one of those things the internet was literally made for. Like, when they were developing the internet, this is the exact kind of thing.
Sharing knowledge.
And what they showed on the Netflix episode, exactly. That's exactly what they were talking about. So, anyway... Yes, go online, go to the UDN Gateway, which is an online portal funded by and run by the NIH, and, you know, you or someone who may be dealing with these things can hopefully use that as a conduit to that kind of visibility and connections to resources. And we talked about this earlier, too, the really vital whole genome sequencing. Which is just, and I'll talk about it in a second, like, really what that is, but just so key to this whole thing. And really is crazy, yeah. And that's the kind of thing that may be necessary to, again, solve these toughest of the tough diagnostic enigmas. So if one gets accepted to the UDN, one is referred to one of 12 clinical sites around the country. And often... one will get the aforementioned whole genome sequencing. So, whole genome sequencing, that is a way to read not just the DNA within the cell nucleus, right? As I was, we were talking about this earlier, it's not just the DNA that tells the body which cells to make and how many to make, but also the rest of the DNA involved in the functioning of the cells. So which particular parts of the DNA to turn on and off, and therefore how the cells actually function.
Do they only look at genetic diseases?
They don't only look at genetic diseases, but many, many of these rare diseases are genetic, in nature.
Diseases? Okay.
So it's a main focus. It's sort of a big focus. And sometimes, you know, you think of genetic as being hereditarily genetic, but that's always not always the case either. Some of these rare diseases are, as they say, sui generis mutations. So they're not something you got from your mom or dad. They're something that was created by a mutation in your body, random mutation, yeah. Or your something body got hit by a gamma wrong. Ray, or some, you know, as we'll talk about in the sort of story that I'm going to talk about, there could be environmental factors involved as well. So we'll get into that too. But sometimes it is sufficient to do this whole genome sequencing in order to, you know, find out what the genetic anomaly is, you know, from wherever it came. So anyway, this is, yeah, looking at sort of the whole range and scope of the DNA involved in the functioning of your body, which is what allows them to get that actual diagnosis, to say exactly this is what it is. So it's not a cure-all like we talked about. It's not going to solve every one of these mysteries, but it has made a significant difference in terms of what I found in my research in solving rare disease cases through the UDN. So that's partly because the cost of the test has come down dramatically by orders of magnitude over the past like 10 or 15 years. Right. So it's more widely available.
It's becoming more accessible.
Exactly. Even in our healthcare system. I'll just say that. If a genetic anomaly is identified, that's when the detective work, you know, sort of the groundwork, right, of the clinicians and the researchers begins. Because it's not necessarily enough to know what the particular genetic anomaly is to know that that's what's causing your disease. So this is kind of a subtle thing, too. One may have a genetic mutation but have a disease, right? But you don't know if that's necessarily what's causing it. So there's sometimes where, you know, they look in this wide database, right, and they say, oh, this mutation, it's rare, but the people who have it don't exhibit these symptoms. So this is probably not what's causing it. Or they may, which is really interesting, do sort of targeted research using genetic manipulation, you know, CRISPR and all that kind of stuff, to introduce the genetic mutation into like a zebrafish or a fruit fly, and then study them
and see how it
exactly and how it expresses,
yes.
how it
manifests
exactly. So that's another kind of way in which they'll look into it. So these clinical investigators will also look for evidence.
What do you do for a living? Oh, you know, I'm a clinical investigator.
Right. Like I said, in these kind of large genetic databases, so that they may connect it, you know, in fact, to someone else who has the genetic anomaly and is suffering from a similar set of symptoms. In essence, in a perfect world, the process for a patient kind of goes like this. It's a series of connections from a person to another person, right, that leads ultimately to a treatment or a cure. You know, that's what we hope will happen, right? That's what happened for, and I'm blanking on her name, Angel, in the Netflix series. So, you know, that's hopefully what will happen.
The first one, the first episode is a happy ending.
Right. Of course, it doesn't always work out that way.
Yeah.
You know, unfortunately, sadly, it saddens me to say that, literally. But the UDN and people like them who are doing this investigative work help to improve the chances. And that's really all that we can hope for with things like this, you know, as we,
right.
So as we touched on in the last episode as well, you know, it helps to create that visibility. That's the other part of it. So, you know, if two people who are suffering from a rare disease, you know, go to the UDN, well, then they're both going to know about each other, right? So it helps to foster that community, that network, because if there's no, you know, if there's one, if there's two patients, as tragic and as important as it is for even, you know, for just one or two people to be suffering from a rare disease. Unfortunately, there won't be any focus on treating it or on finding a cure.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know the answer to this. You said people get accepted. Why wouldn't want you get accepted?
Because you don't, in fact, have the kind of condition or disease that they would, you know, be helpful in looking into. I'm not sure. Maybe other factors. Maybe you have comorbidities that just, you know, they wouldn't necessarily be able to, I don't know.
I'm not sure. They wouldn't be able to help you in the first place.
That's what I would imagine.
I bet some people fly thinking they have, like, one thing and they don't.
Or maybe they have a diagnosis, but they want a second opinion and maybe that's not really what they're there for.
Right.
I'm not totally sure. Again, creating that network, right? If even a relatively small group of patients and advocates band together to create that visibility, then there's that incentive for researchers, pharmaceutical companies to take action. David Adams, a pediatrician with the NIH, sums up the goals of the UDN like this, quote, "It is our hope that the Gateway will serve as a model for rare disease research, minimizing the practical distance between families and subject experts who may be anywhere in the world." Right. Close quote. And of course, that was the case for Angel, although it wasn't technically through this. But it's really that practical distance, right? The internet can eschew physical distance, but it takes networks like this to, you know, get rid of the practical distance. Okay, so that's just one example of people trying to make things better for patients, families, etc. Obviously, there's other good examples out there. So, yes. Now let's dig into a more particular story from another long-form article. We love our long-form articles on Mystery Murder Thingy.
Yes.
That will highlight the theme that I mentioned last episode of environmental justice, because that's sort of intrinsically linked with rare diseases, right? There are certain instances, famous instances, multiple, more than just this, obviously, where that sort of paradox that we discussed last time as well, that rare diseases can be more common among a certain subset of the population or in a certain location.
Right,
where it sort of belies the, you know, name of rare disease. So courtesy of the writer Joshua Sharp for Atlanta Magazine, we're going to be exploring one of these stories in Georgia, Waycross, Georgia, to be exact, rural Waycross, Georgia, or semi-rural at least. So the mystery plaguing Waycross, and this is, you know, sort of in the, what are we looking at here, in sort of the mid-20s, the mystery plaguing Waycross at that time can best be summed up by the headline to the article by Joshua. Quote, "Why are so many people getting rare cancers in this small Georgia town?" Close quote. Oh. I thought that was just such a great summation of that. And it has a lot of inherent interest to anyone who's interested in these subjects, but obviously to those people as well. Right. It's a very chilling and dire mystery to those people. And again, we want to focus on the people.
Is
and
it
we,
the water?
We definitely need to do that.
Well, I guess we don't know.
Well,
do we know?
Well, it's a mystery podcast, so probably not going to get a super satisfying answer, but I don't want to give it away because I've got about 3 pages to go here before we get to anything that's even close to an answer. So let's dig in. So, yeah, this is also when creepy terms like cancer cluster come into play.
Oh, love that.
And you may or may not have heard that term, and a higher incidence of cancer, which, you know, obviously may be caused by some sort of environmental.
Common?
Well, no, I mean, by their very nature, cancer clusters aren't common, but it refers to the fact that a certain type of cancer is more unusually common, alarmingly common, in a certain area.
Okay.
And tragically, a cancer cluster seemed like it may be developing in 2015 around Waycross, Georgia, specifically when 3 children were diagnosed with rhabdomyosarcoma in this, like I said, small industrial Georgia town. And RMS, as it's known for short, is a cancer of the connective tissues around the muscles. And this sort of out-of-control proliferation of the connective tissue cells can cause very painful masses, swelling, other symptoms. Sometimes it can develop around the eye and cause ocular issues, you know, depending on where it presents within the body. And it can be almost anywhere within the body where there's that sort of connective tissue. Weird. And it's also very rare, with only about a dozen cases reported in Georgia every year. And obviously seeing three of these in a small town, right, is a sort of alarm bell. So RMS also has no cure and also no proven cause. In other words, it's been determined that it's not able to be determined what actually could cause it, which is actually not uncommon in cancer.
Able to be determined meaning like it could be so many factors that they can't pick one or the other way around.
When you're talking about determining the cause of a disease, you have to identify a pathway. So a medical investigator would have to say, you know, for example, this genetic anomaly causes this malformed, protein, which causes this cell to proliferate, which is causing a tumor, right? There has to be like a chain of causation.
Okay.
Whereas with rhabdomyosarcoma, there's not able to be a there's just no established way to know what the link is to cause it.
Okay.
So that chain of causation can't be established. Even if you can say that there's a likelihood that it was caused by a certain source because it is known to be carcinogenic, which means cancer causing, you can't say for sure that this thing caused your rhabdomyosarcoma. So again, just laying that out there, right? We're probably not given any definitive answers. So just want to be real clear about that.
That's the mystery.
Crazy. Right. So yes, as I find my place here on the page. So in a sense, this diagnosis is inherently a mystery, right? But that doesn't mean that no one has any idea either, as we'll get into. So after another child, the fourth now, was diagnosed with a Ewing sarcoma, related and also incurable cancer, the parents of Waycross, Georgia, at the very least, and other citizens, obviously, were pretty certain that something was going on. Something had to be going on, right? And in fact, 2 years earlier, a local Waycross resident named Joan Tibor created a group called Silent Disaster, quote, to spread the word about pollution in town, close quote.
Ooh.
Right, so
that's a very intriguing name.
Silent Disaster?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, great naming. Great branding. Because, yes, it just brings up, you know, that image in your mind immediately, right? So, yes, there was and is a lot of pollution in and around Waycross, Georgia. Like, that's not a mystery, right? So the fact that there were people looking into it also, you know, definitely makes sense. So when this was happening, though, when these diagnoses were coming to light, the Georgia Department of Public Health and eventually a division of the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, would come in and look into this mystery of whether the industrial actors in and around Waycross were, in fact, negligently poisoning residents and giving children cancer. To not put it too bluntly, right?
Jesus!
Not that they were doing it on purpose, mind you. You know, I don't want to make, like, unfounded accusations, but I do want to make founded accusations. I don't want to shy away from saying what it is. You know, that's the scope of what we're looking at here. The residents of Waycross, in other words, as Joshua put it in his article, were, quote, forced to consider whether the industries that gave it life could now be taking lives back, close quote. It's really good article. Perfect. A lot of good phrasing in this article. I like it. The investigation and notion that the heavy industries in town may be culpable divided opinion within the town, as you can imagine.
Seems about right.
Right. Some saw the notion of a cancer cluster as a consequence of busybody residents and carpetbaggers making stuff up, you know, and trying to make trouble for the good people of Waycross.
Sometimes I wish that I believed stuff like that.
Right. Ignorance bliss, that sort of thing.
Bliss.
on the other hand, were residents who themselves or family members had been affected by a rare disease or otherwise felt that their health had been impacted, you know. So while residents debated, the authorities investigated. And they had, like I said before, a lot to investigate in terms of possible contamination or environmental hazard in and around Waycross. As nearby, you know, and sort of emblematic of that, nearby Ware County, and they call it like Waycross, Ware County. It's like this one sort of, you know, unified area has 9 of the most contaminated sites in the state, according to Joshua's article. And there was also a one-time federal Superfund site as well nearby. And Superfund sites are sort of places that are really heavily polluted and probably are causing some, you know, ongoing imminent harm to people. And, you know, there had been remediation and so forth, but obviously this is more than their fair share. And this is sort of, you know, when we talk about environmental justice, that's what we're talking about, right? Some people are bearing more than their fair share of environmental hazards in this country, whereas other people are not. And that implicates a lot of other things that, you know, I could go on for a long time about.
Fair share.
Yeah. So, right. What does that even mean?
Rather have no share. Right.
Exactly. But, you know, for example, when the EPA calculates the, you know, load, right, the presence of environmental toxins or contaminants in the air, they take an average, and they specifically and intentionally take their readings from outside of known areas of high concentration because they want to get an average over a large area.
Okay, they want it to be accurate?
They want it to be accurate, right? So it makes sense scientifically, but it also doesn't capture the experience of the people like these people in Waycross, Georgia, who are living near these sites and who aren't experiencing the average. They're experiencing what they experience, which is probably much higher. But we're not doing the readings, you know, on a regular basis necessary to establish that.
Oh.
And when you don't have data, you don't, you know, the things don't get done. So again, it's sort of a whole ball of wax. Yeah. Okay. Again, trying to find... I'm getting off on a lot of tangents this episode.
No, but this is good.
Right.
Because that makes a lot... It makes sense as to why. It gives us a why.
Yeah.
Or a possible.
Demystify a little bit, at least. Okay, so meanwhile. That's one of my famous meanwhiles.
Meanwhile.
The first local child diagnosed with rhabdomyosarcoma, Lexi Crawford, is... And again, this is around 2015, is dealing with the pain and nausea. And
how old is she?
14. Oh, 14, 15. And going through things I can't even begin to imagine.
Right.
Caused by her cancer and the chemotherapy fighting it. And by the summer of 2016, Lexi's hair had fallen out entirely as she suffered through the long-shot treatment that she hoped and her family and everyone else hoped would save her life. Her fate and those of the other children affected at this point remained very much a mystery. Mm. Others in town began to contemplate whether their relatives, the author himself, actually, and his mom, who died of cancer many years before this, you know, he started to kind of think about this too. You know, had their friend who was afflicted with a rare cancer or other disease, you know, could they be part of a pattern? And could this be a pattern? Is there a pattern?
Yeah, everybody,
you know,
it's kind of like a, not an epidemic, but like, I don't know how to explain it. People are scared.
Yes. One enterprising resident who had been looking into some of these mysteries for some years was a woman named Nelia Griffin, who contracted breast cancer herself several years earlier, and it eventually was seemingly cured by a combination of, I believe it was chemotherapy and a double mastectomy.
Okay.
So once she kind of, you know, went past her treatment phase, she made it her mission to find out why she had gotten the much, much harder question, right, of why she had gotten the cancer that she had gotten in the first place.
Wow, she went on to explore that herself?
Yeah,
she just... That takes guts.
Exactly. She just, like, took this on as her mission. It's very impressive. And once she... So yes, that led her to investigate a number of possible sources of harmful contamination in and around Waycross, right? We keep cycling back to that, right? The fact that...
Contamination.
That there are these sites, we know there are these places that have contamination, and, like, what is that doing? What is that doing to the people?
That's the question.
That's the question. That's the big mystery here.
So, aye, there's the rub.
Ah, yes. She actually... Nelia took Joshua Sharp, the article writer, on what he calls, quote, the kind of tour no chamber of commerce would ever sanction, close quote. Because they're essentially just going by, like, the most polluted places around town. So their first stop was a shuttered wastewater treatment facility called Seven Out. And it had only operated from about 2002 to 2004, and left in its wake, in the wake of its closure, a number of immense containers full of contaminated water. What? They just left them there.
Were there any consequences?
Well...
From the company?
Not to them, seemingly. Not that I heard of, certainly. In early...
Is that legal? Sorry. Keep going.
In early 2005... wastewater was seen, this is not funny at all, in early 2005, wastewater was seen flowing from at least one of these containers into the Waycross Canal system.
Fuck.
So, like, that did happen.
Holy shit.
And the EPA eventually removed 350,000 gallons of waste.
That's sickening.
Yeah, so news of this incident also did not reach the local residents till... I'll lovingly call the benevolent busybody Joan Tibor brought it out into the open in 2013. So this, like, 7 years later.
She was like, oh, fun fact, everybody, here's
she
what
was,
happened.
She was, like, looking through, records in, like, the town hall. I mean, really, like, some of these people are just, they're very impressive. Like, the lengths to which they go to try to solve these mysteries,
I mean,
in their community. Like, it's,
the whole community's on your shoulders, you feel like, right?
That's probably how she feels, you know, yeah. And she seems like she's one of the you know, I mean, obviously I have no idea, right? I just read this one article, but, you know, at least, you know, she's definitely bearing her load for the community, it seems. So anyway, local residents were assured at that point, right, that no lasting harm was done, but obviously they were left wondering, and, you know, why they weren't told about it, and, you know, whether the officials that were telling them that could really be believed. Nelia and Joshua, continuing our tour that no chamber of commerce would ever sanction, also visited the sort of centerpiece of Waycross, Georgia, called the CSX Rice Yard, which is a rail yard named for W. Thomas Rice, a 19th century railroad baron, whose descendants, I'm pretty sure, don't live anywhere near the yard named after him.
I mean...
Right? And the yard is... right. So, not to get too snarky, but the yard is a crossroads, thus the name of the town, for train routes, including the moving of chemical waste, paint thinners, kind of chemical waste products. Some of that waste ended up being dumped into the soil in the 1980s for several years before regulators put a stop to the practice. Essentially, they were found to be running an unsanctioned chemical disposal facility.
So do you think it's ignorance or greed?
Some of it was ignorance. The particular contaminant that may be the most harmful, it wasn't known that it was carcinogenic until into the
80s. Okay.
And they did eventually stop using it, but there was this period that we know that this did happen. And when CSX, the company that bought the yard, bought it in 1986, they created a remediation effort, including 150 wells linked to a system to pull in and treat groundwater, which they claim has treated more than 620 million gallons. So it's not like they did nothing.
They went in and
Yeah, they're trying to clean things up. Now, how much of that contamination is left is a mystery.
Yeah, there's a lot. Oh God, there's so much going on here.
Yeah. So as of the 2010 census, about 4,000 people, including about 500 children younger than 6, lived within a mile of the yard. Just a factoid. and the canal that runs by the yard also runs all over town, potentially spreading contaminated water far from even the very expansive train yard itself. In March of 2016, the investigators from the CDC's Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, so that's the particular division that was, like, looking into this, were ready to announce their findings to the concerned citizens of Waycross. One such citizen was James Thomas, whose wife was diagnosed with brain cancer, unfortunately, after they moved near the railroad and canal in Waycross. Reportedly, he was the first person to arrive and told one of the federal investigators that, quote, the state's nothing but a pack of liars, close quote.
Keep going.
Eventually, the investigators disclosed that they did find a toxic substance, TCE. This is what I was talking about earlier, that, you know, wasn't known to actually be carcinogenic until about 30, 35 years ago. In the soil, they found TCE in the soil around the rail yard, like in 2015 when they were doing the, investigation. But they said that they could not necessarily identify a known pathway from that contamination to a possible exposure by Lexi and the other children. So what they said was, well, we know, yes, TCE is here, but it's here. It's in the soil. It's in the ground over here. And then their houses are, like, over here.
They didn't find, like, they didn't, like, tap into their water line and find it or something.
Well, I was going to get into that at the end. But no, it's not answering the question. The water itself, the drinking water, is not part of this. That comes from an aquifer from Florida and has in no way anything to do with this. So I guess I'll just answer that question now. So
You said the canal earlier.
Right, the canal is not the drinking water.
Okay.
Yeah, so the drinking water doesn't come from a well or canal or anything in Waycross itself. It comes from Florida.
Okay.
So yeah, the drinking water has nothing to do with it. So it's more like physical exposure, as we'll kind of get into in a little while. So even if it could be determined, they said, that there was some possible physical exposure to TCE by these children, they still couldn't necessarily know that it caused their cancer. Right.
Which
again, we already knew. And people already knew TCE was there. People already knew all this stuff. They didn't find anything.
But this is the first
anything.
Time they're talking about it, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's the first time these federal investigators are talking about it. The whole thing is kind of frustrating, as you can imagine. So in the end, little of the core mystery, right, of, you know, what's happening, why is it happening to these people, is resolved to anyone's satisfaction. Right. A year after that, and Lexi Crawford is responding pretty well to the treatment for her rhabdomyosarcoma. She's returned to school, but still is left, you know, with the mystery of how long her cancer will remain at bay. And through Joshua's investigative reporting, though, Lexi and her parents did start to determine a possible cause of the cancer, if it was linked to the contamination. And this is kind of the physical exposure part of it that I was talking about earlier.
This is the if?
This could be. This is sort of our best guess as to what, you know, it could be. So a pond adjacent to the rail yard in which Lexi and other children swam may have been contaminated with CTE. It wasn't directly tested, so we don't actually know.
Okay.
But it could have been, and that could have been the possible cause of the exposure. So Lexi did go there almost every day in the time leading to up to her diagnosis.
Interesting.
And she also used to play in an actual part of the canal that's closer to the rail yard itself. And that, you know, to me, that seems like the more likely cause if this was the cause of it, that that's where it may have been. Because according to Joshua in his article, the closest known contaminated part of the rail yard, like soil, is about 3/4 of a mile from the pond. And like
where
I said,
she swam all the time.
Right. And like I said, there are these wells that are kind of keeping it not perfectly, but, you know, pretty well on the site itself. So even if it were the cause, it still also leaves the mystery of why didn't the other kids who played in these areas get sick? You know, why was it just her? So that, you know, again, it's like the, you questions. Close one door and another door opens, right? So by May of 2017, Lexi and another of the affected children had unfortunately passed away.
Oh, my God.
And unfortunately, she was not able to be cured through her treatment. So, yeah, sad. Very, very
but
sad.
They still don't really know. There's still so much
But obviously, right, we continue to look into it. So the next summer, 2018, the CDC releases a mostly inconclusive report, of course, on possible contamination from the rail yard and its, you know, effects. The report doesn't address other possible sources of contamination in and around Waycross. So it was a pretty limited...
Aren't there nine, you
said? Well, that's in sort of the wider area, also in Ware County. But certainly there's more than just the CSX, you know, rice yard to look at in town as well. So they formally determined that there was not a cancer cluster, although instead of using sort of data as of where the patients lived, like when they were diagnosed or when whatever, they used the location of the hospital where they were diagnosed for some reason. So they just basically excluded four of the five cases, including Lexi's, as not being like part of Waycross. It didn't make any sense to me. So the whole notion of whether there was a cancer cluster, technically they say no, but I feel like it's still a mystery for sure.
They didn't look at... Are you saying that they didn't look at the core places?
When they determine when the state determines whether a cancer cluster occurs, the data that they use, right, to determine whether in a physical area it's actually a cluster is where the hospital is where the patient was diagnosed. So if I, for example, right, I live in Bloomington Normal, but if I went to Peoria and got diagnosed there, it would count for Peoria. And then if another resident of Bloomington Normal got diagnosed here, it would count for here. So even though we both live in the same town, we wouldn't count as being in the same town for purposes of the determination of a cancer cluster. So
that's kind of...
Yeah.
Okay.
So it
okay,
seems...
Okay, I guess.
Yeah, it doesn't really make sense. So, yes. Ultimately, they determined that it was unlikely that contamination from the canal could have caused disease because it was found at too low of levels. Although, to me, right, detection is different than level of exposure. So I don't really know how they can say that if they don't know how often these people were exposed or at what levels they were exposed. If you're just taking one test and you say, okay, if I get exposed to the one amount that's in that one test, maybe not. But what if I get exposed repeatedly? Or what if I get exposed, you know, more than what's in that test? I don't know. It doesn't, again, there's a lot of holes to poke in this, I think. And people certainly did so. You know, people like Joan Tibor, people like the parents of the patients, you know, obviously. And other people who are wondering, again, you know, am I part of this? Is my family part of this too? Investigators also said that the ground filtration system seemed to work well, which I don't, you know, have any indication that it didn't necessarily, but they did say that there were three known instances between 2001 and 2013 when contamination seeped just outside the rail yard's bounds, including in areas that were closer to where Lexi lived. So that, you know, obviously could be part of it as well. CSX, the company, again, that owns the rail yard, essentially took this as vindication. Most of the residents of Waycross weren't really moved one way or the other. And in the end, you know, like so many mysteries surrounding rare diseases, we're left with a lot of maybes, a lot of unsatisfying answers.
Wow, that was really good.
So, and I could do three more episodes on this. Seriously, there are so many good stories out there and interesting stories about the people dealing with this and solving these kind of mysteries. But someday I'll do another one, but y'all look and I'll tweet out some of the sources as well. And some of the other ones that, you know, I didn't quite get to from the official account. Okay. So my sources though were Sean Kapton at Fast Company, Wikipedia, the Undiagnosed Disease Network and Rare Disease Pages, Kelly Clancy at Wired, Ed Yong at Pacific Standard, Pacific Standard, excuse me, Joshua Sharp at Atlanta Magazine, the American Cancer Society webpage, Shirley Leung at Boston Globe, and that episode of Diagnosis that we mentioned earlier.
Wow.
Yeah, so...
That was very in-depth. That was crazy.
Yeah, no, it's a really crazy story that he tells in the article. No, it's really interesting. Well, thanks for listening, y'all.
Mario, don't you have weird shit in the news?
Okay, I wasn't sure whether we were going to do it or not.
Oh, so, is it late?
No, what? It's okay. No, it's fine, Ooh-ha. So I was just going to mention it because I thought it was interesting. So I read this article earlier, and I don't even remember where I read it. But anyway, it was about Tom Hanks, you know, our friend Tom, and right? And, you know, how he's playing Mr. Rogers, right, in the upcoming movie about Mr. Rogers. Apparently, he's also related to Mr. Rogers, to Fred Rogers. And they are sixth cousins. They share a relative who lived in, was born in 1732, I believe it said. So, distant, but hey, they're, you know, it's a weird connection. It's weird, right? It's weird. Counts. Also good. I felt like it was good shit in the news because it has to do with, you know, Mr. Rogers and...
Everybody likes Mr. Rogers.
And Tom Hanks. Everybody likes Tom Hanks, you know.
On World Kindness Day, they put newborns in hand-knitted sweaters.
I saw that. Yep. I definitely
so
saw
cute.
That.
Aw. So
right.
Cute.
Yeah, so I guess that's it for this week pretty much. I'm taking over our Twitter page, and I'm trying to do a little bit more.
I'm so bad at it.
It's fine. We're getting it restarted, and so I've already tweeted out a couple of things, so I'll be tweeting out some of my highlights of my sources and all that stuff.
Just check it out. Check it out.
Well, I can't tell them what I'm going to do.
This is right. No, just kidding.
Okay.
You have to follow the page to find out.
Go to at Murderby Thingy to find out.
To find more.
Okay.
Okay, bye. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thanks. Don't forget to tell your friends.